This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost half the world's people and most of the great rivers depend on water from the mountains. But that vital resource is destabilized and disappearing. Our first guest, Dr. John Pomeroy, reports back from the High Mountain Summit in Geneva. He reveals secrets of snow and permafrost and carbon. Then from Queensland, Australia, Dr. Sean Maxwell explains why intact tropical forests count for 6 times more carbon than we thought. Those distant places may determine how hot, stormy, or flooded your future may be. I'm Alex Smith. This is the worldwide broadcast of Radio EcoShock. World experts just gathered in Geneva at the High Mountain Summit. The problem? Up to half of the world's people get their water from mountains, but that is threatened by a changing climate. Dr. John Pomeroy is a Canadian expert on hydrology and co-chair of that summit. Pomeroy is director of Global Water Futures and leads many other institutions, including as Canada Research Chair in Water Resources and Climate Change. We reach John at his home University of Saskatchewan in Canada. From Saskatoon, John Pomeroy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Pleased to be on.
In 2013, I went to visit family in Calgary, Canada, and large parts of the city had just flooded. It was epic. Please talk to us about that flood and what we learned from it.
Well, that was a very interesting event. I was further up the river from where you were, near Canmore, Alberta, and we had about 15 research scientists out there taking measurements of the hydrology, and then the storm hit. And it was fascinating because there was a substantial late-season snowpack. Even though it was late June, there was still a lot of snow up high in the mountains. And so much of the rain fell on the snow, carried with it lots of energy, which melted the snow very rapidly. It's called the rain-on-snow melt event, and they're famous for causing floods. And that contributed to the flooding. So there was roughly 250 millimeters of precipitation that fell during the event, but another 100 millimeters in many areas of snowmelt added to that. And it came very quickly. And also, the flows were not just water, but it was debris mixed in with the stream flow. So the debris it carried was highly destructive and destroyed river channels, stream channels, bridges, wiped out the Trans-Canada Highway, the Canadian Pacific Main Line that goes east-west across Canada, and then carried on downstream. The reason the debris was in there is partly because of deglaciation in the mountains. Many glaciers above the Front Ranges had receded over the last few decades and left vast amounts of rubble and boulders ready to be washed away. So, you know, you could almost say deglaciation loaded the gun, and then the rain was the firing that caused all this to come down. It ended up being the most expensive natural disaster in Canadian history to that time, $6 billion of damage. Much of downtown Calgary was flooded. Other smaller towns and cities around there, Canmore, High River, a few others were severely impacted. But when we looked at it statistically, 3 events of this magnitude are typically expected to occur in every century. So you'd argue a return period of about 1 in 35 years. Not that high. So we should have been prepared for it, and we should have had an early warning system to give substantial warning that this event was coming. In fact, in Canmore, the forecast that the rivers would be flooding came after the evacuations had already started.
So a lot of my listeners don't live near the mountains, and why would they care about what happens with mountain water?
Well, this is just one example, but, you know, Calgary is 100 kilometers east of the mountains, and yet still affected by a mountain flood. But rivers that drain the mountains supply water to over half of humanity around the world. In Asia, you know, the Ganges, the Indus, the Yellow, the Yangtze, the Mekong all drain out of the Hindu Kush, Himalaya, and Tibetan Plateau region. Similarly, in the United States, the Colorado, famously, the Missouri, the Columbia all drain out of the mountains. And as you go to Europe, the Rhine, the Rhone, the others, Danube coming out of the mountains. Even further Australia, the Murray Darling has some important headwaters in these snowy mountains. So there are a disproportionate amount of stream flow generated in high mountain regions. And this is also where climate change impacts are seen most profoundly. We get some enhanced climate warming at high elevations. We're losing the snow and ice up there, so we call that snow and ice together the cryosphere, but we're losing it rapidly as temperatures warm up. And, of course, then these are the headwaters of our rivers, so all this change is occurring upstream from where much of the human population lives and where we produce our food is downstream of these mountain regions. So what happens there affects everyone on the planet. The viability of our cities, our ability to generate electricity through hydropower, our ability to grow food through irrigation. And you can even argue that the earliest human civilizations in the Indus, Tigris, Euphrates, valleys, the Yellow River, were all based upon managing water from mountains.
So you just co-chaired the High Mountain Summit at the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva. Why have a summit?
Well, there has been a focus on climate change in the polar regions. We hear lots about Greenland and Antarctica and the ice sheets melting, and these are very, very serious problems causing sea level rises. We hear less about what's occurring in the high mountains. For instance, the melt of mountain glaciers is contributing to sea level rise. We can expect as much as a third of a meter of sea level rise from mountain glaciers. And the mountain glaciers are melting right now. We've already lost hundreds of thousands of these around the world. And in any particular mountain range, hundreds to thousands. So this is going on as we speak. And it's also something that is manageable because we manage the water supplies coming from the mountains. So there are things that we can do about it. There are solutions that we can find to some of the problems that this raises. And that made it a very important focal point for the UN to focus its efforts.
And it's so difficult to see what will happen. I mean, on one hand, large parts of the Earth will get drier, but the atmosphere overall will get wetter, and then we have extreme precipitation events popping up, whether it falls as rain or snow. It's hard to see how you can predict any one thing about what's going to happen in the high mountains.
Well, one thing is that many of our weather models were designed to, provide a good forecast for a level place. I think Kansas in the United States or other areas that are fairly simple topography. And these models don't do very well in the mountains. One saying in the Canadian Rockies, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. It changes rapidly, but also changes over short distances. And so we need high-resolution atmospheric models in order to predict the weather, but also to look at changes to climate that might occur over long periods of time. And this is one of the things that the High Mountain Summit was calling for, is that we have to develop these models so we have some better predictability of what is occurring and will be occurring in the mountains.
Well, there is some new dam construction. The Three Gorges Dam in China is fairly recent. There's others on the go in Asia. But in general, most of the world's big hydro dams were built in the 1900s. Why does it matter when the dams were built?
Yes, the climate and the hydrological regime when those dams were built has changed substantially already and will be changing further over the next few decades. So in the 20th century, the high mountains had most of their precipitation, generally as snowfall, and they would store it up over the winter, and spring would come and the snow would melt, and then the dams would store that water to make hydroelectricity when there is demand for it, or to store it until such time as farmers needed water for irrigation. And often that was not a very long time. So they might store the water in April and May from runoff and then use it for irrigation in June and July. But without the snowfall, with mountain rainfall, which is what we're seeing more and more of, then the precipitation might be occurring in January and have to be stored until June or July. So now we're looking at 6 months of storage, which the dams weren't designed for. And also, when you get a heavy precipitation event under a colder climate that we used to have, it would come a snowfall. And we call that good skiing. When we have that heavy precipitation as rainfall under warmer climate, it can be a disastrous flood. So the dams and structures that we built may not be able to withstand those extreme events.
Is mountain water involved in the growing phenomenon of large cities actually running out of potable water? We've seen more news stories about that in the past year or two.
Well, some of Cape Town's water was, in fact, from highland, upland areas, for sure. It wasn't really the high mountains, per se. It's becoming an issue more in Asia, where you have 1.6 billion people living off the waters from the Himalayas, the Hindu Kush and those areas, and there are certainly communities in the Himalayas that are experiencing extreme drought right now and will have to relocate. So that's already happening to some of them. In terms of the impact on the large cities, so far the mountains have been sufficiently reliable to maintain them. But there are problems coming in the Andes in very short order, and in the rivers that drain the Hindu Kush, particularly the Indus River, will have already has problems, and they'll become much more severe. And the issues of those two types of river basins is that they have glaciers, which is great, but the glaciers melt during the dry season. And when there aren't other sources of water to form stream flow, and the glaciers are shrinking rapidly. So without the glaciers, that dry season will be absolutely arid in terms of stream flow, whereas right now there is enough water to supply the cities and the irrigation in that area, in those areas.
Once those glaciers are gone, they're gone. So I have seen several news stories, even this fall, of glaciers about to burst or floods coming out of the mountains in the Alps of Switzerland and Italy. Are you expecting more sort of news disasters coming because we don't know enough about mountain water supplies and how to manage them?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. As the glaciers retreat, they start to physically disintegrate, and sometimes that can cause them to dam up water and form a lake that's dammed by the ice, and then the ice continues to melt and the lake is released very quickly. These are called GLOFs, glacial lake outburst floods. And they tend to kill a lot of people when they happen, often, sometimes up to thousands. They occur without warning and can be devastating, just like having a dam burst when it's a human-made dam. But they are detectable using satellite remote sensing, and it is possible to develop early warning systems for these, and such systems would save vast numbers of lives.
And when I look at a long list of groundbreaking studies you co-authored, where very few people looked before, I suspect that may come partly from your roots in the Canadian Prairie province of Saskatchewan. Why does Saskatchewan need to know a lot about water?
Well, Saskatchewan is a long way from the Rockies. It's 700 to 800 kilometers from Saskatoon to the Rockies, depending how you drive. But it's a semi-arid province. It actually receives very little precipitation itself, and it's a food-producing province, so it'll grow lots of grain. The other thing is that groundwater supplies are not very reliable in Saskatchewan. So people, if they can, use the rivers for their water supply, and the rivers come from the mountains. In fact, the South Saskatchewan River in the city of Saskatoon, where I live, about 80 to 90% of its stream flow comes from the Rocky Mountains. So these rivers provide water to a parched land, and that water is used for the cities, it's used for potash mines, it's used for irrigation. It's piped hundreds of kilometers away from the rivers in some cases, and it's used for hydroelectric power. So it absolutely makes life in the Canadian prairies far better and more dynamic than it would have been without.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is a senior scientist, hydrology expert, Dr. John Pomeroy from the University of Saskatchewan, Canada. And John, you were part of a 10-year international effort to develop and share water information from river basins where nobody measures the water flows. And I was thinking, well, that must mean less developed countries, maybe in Africa. But then I'm thinking, there must be vast amounts of water running around in northern Canada without being monitored. Where are these ungauged basins, as you call them?
Oh, you've hit it on the head. Northern Canada is very sparsely gauged. There aren't many stream flow gauges because of the remoteness of the rivers, the lack of roads, and it's very expensive to put a stream gauge there when you have to maintain it, visiting by helicopter, things like this. So Canada shares the experience of having vast parts of its territory ungauged with countries that might be in the what's traditionally called the developing world or less developed world. And we've also at times when we've had budget cutbacks at the federal government level or provincial government levels, we've lost gauging networks. And it's often the most remote north that we lose. So we've had to develop techniques to estimate stream flow without a gauge. That's quite useful. It's a very difficult thing to do, but it's a very useful thing to do, and it's the sort of technology that's also useful to countries that, for various reasons, have not been able to maintain or afford to continue their stream gauging networks.
And on top of that lack of basic data when it comes to water, you also talk about unwillingness to publish or share information because of security concerns. Can you talk to us about an example or two?
Well, there are unfortunately many around the world. The world's nations have a very good record of sharing weather data, primarily because of aviation, but other reasons as well. But water data is seen as proprietary. Sometimes it's because of a hydroelectric utility that its business depends on the stream flow, and so they may not want others to know too much about its business. There may be other concerns. Many river basins travel from one country to another, and so there isn't always cooperation on sharing that data about what's coming downstream, in particular what's been used upstream. But without that information, that basic information on water, we can't work out ways to share it equitably and fairly. And we also need these for flood forecasting systems. If a flood is moving downstream from one country, the countries downstream need to know that as soon as possible. So there's many, many reasons to share the data. And there are good examples, but there are also many examples where we don't know very much. But this is where satellites can come in. And there are new satellites that will be up in a year or two, one called SWOT, which can measure the height of a river from space. And then that's going to revolutionize things because it will no longer be possible to not share the levels in a stream.
John Pomeroy, you've produced so much in your career. I developed a short list of important topics that probably need half an hour each, but let's try and touch on a couple. And one that really interests me is snow contaminants. What is that about?
Well, it's snow chemistry. And, you know, we always think of snow coming down as white, as pure as the driven snow. And nothing could be further than the truth. The snow is a great scrubber. The snowflakes coming down pick up aerosols and other contaminants from the atmosphere, and they can hold them over the winter. And then also contaminants, pollution is deposited on the snow over the winter over the many months that we might have a snow-covered season. And so slowly accumulates snow that way. And then you get strange things going on. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to study blizzards in the Scottish Highlands, and the blowing snow particles develop an electrical charge that attracts aerosols to the particles, a bit like an electrified scrubber air cleaner. And so you, at that time, this is the 1980s, would develop a gray to black blowing snowstorm with a pH of 2.6. It was acidic. It would burn your eyes if the snow got in your eyes. And that was scrubbing out air pollution that had come from Eastern Europe and blown over Scotland. So you get very strange things occurring sometimes. A lot of the acid rain problems that we had in northern Canada and in Scandinavia and elsewhere several decades ago were really acid snowmelt problems. And it was the storage of these chemicals in the snow and then the rapid release of them. And it's still a problem. In the Canadian prairies, we're very concerned about nitrogen and phosphorus runoff to our water bodies because they over-fertilize the water and we get toxic algae blooms as a result. And so we're trying to understand how they run off from snowmelt a bit better, and then also how farmers can manage their fields to keep the fertilizers in place on the soil rather than in the lakes downstream.
Well, let's talk a bit about snow cover depletion. Has this become a problem for farmers in Saskatchewan? Can it affect the wheat crop that Canada exports to help feed a hungry world? Has climate change altered snow cover?
Oh, it has. Around the world, many parts of the northern hemisphere have already lost 1 to 2 months of snow cover since the late 1960s. The first satellites measuring this were around 1970. So that's been noticed. In Saskatchewan, there 2 to 3 weeks of snow cover has been noticed. Snowfall used to be one-third of the yearly precipitation. It's down to one-fifth in many areas. So you have a longer summer, yet it's not wetted up very much. And it's much more difficult to get through that longer summer. So this year, we had a fairly low snowpack and an early melt, and then we had a drought. Just a few millimeters of rain from late March until June, into late June. And so the grains, the seeds that were planted in the spring didn't germinate. Very slow germination, lack of growth, and it caused great problems for farmers. It was followed by a subsequent wet period, extraordinary wet period. So the crops finally grew, but they grew a month late in July because they didn't have that boost from the snowmelt water. And then it stayed wet, and then the snows came in September. So the farmers weren't able to harvest the crop, and it was the worst harvest in terms of getting the crop off since 1980 in Saskatchewan. So not having that spring snowmelt at the right time just messes up the whole system through the summer and can create terrible problems in terms of being able to produce food in this part of the world.
And I've talked with scientists who say, too, that the changes in snow cover in the far north, where it's going away earlier and coming later, is exposing more dark earth and forest and then changing the reflection of energy to space and actually a factor in adding to global warming. It's a feedback effect.
Yes, yes. It's a very strong one. There's a strong feedback between losing your snow cover and then air temperatures. Essentially, they're very hard for air temperatures to remain much above zero whilst there's still snowpack and snow cover on the land. Once it's gone, then the land heats up and the air heats up above it, and then you rapidly get an increase in temperature. So that's seen everywhere. And some cases where snowpacks are dropping, you have increased plant exposure, and the plants themselves are dark. These can be shrubs, for instance, and they'll heat up in the sun and accelerate the snowmelt. So there's some feedback. So as you start to get shallower and shallower snow covers, then the exposed plants accelerate the melt rate, and you get a shorter snow season as well. And that's happening practically everywhere.
Another of your co-authored papers that caught my eye, this time published in 2018, it was titled Recent Changes to the Hydrological Cycle of an Arctic Basin at the Tundra-Taiga Transition. Look, you're talking about a giant band of territory that occurs almost right around the Earth, wherever there's land, and yet we know practically nothing about it. What is your research showing?
Yeah, that's an interesting area. So this is now the far, far north. We're close to 70 degrees north latitude. First, we looked at the trends since 1960, where measurements began in that area. And we actually see the hydrology slowing down a little bit. It's becoming cloudier over time. It's warming up, but not really wetting up so far. And so that surprised us a bit. But then we used very high-resolution climate models to run the climate forward toward the end of the 21st century. And we saw some surprises. So instead of a slowing hydrological cycle, we saw a rapidly accelerating hydrological cycle. And this was because of almost a doubling of the amount of precipitation. And a lot of it occurring in winter, so it's falling as snow. So here the snowpack's going up. And then a very warm spring to give a rapid snowmelt. And so the peak stream flows more than doubled in that region, which is fairly problematic because the culverts under the highways, the villages, the infrastructure is all designed for flows that are much smaller than what we're predicting for later in the 21st century. The other thing that's happening is the permafrost is thawing in that region, and it has been and will continue to even more rapidly. And permafrost is the ground which doesn't thaw in a normal year. So it's ground that is often composed of a mixture of ice and sediment. And if you dig into it, it looks icy, looks like dirty ice. And when that thaws, you get a collapse of the landscape. The trees topple over. If you have a town or a building, the building will slump over, highway will collapse, and where there are forests will become open wetlands. So it's quite destructive as that permafrost thaws. This is exactly what's happening in northern Canada, northern Russia, many other areas. The model also showed a substantial increase in the thaw of permafrost and the increasing thickness of what's called the active layer. This is a layer of soil above that permafrost, which does thaw every summer.
And that is one of the scary stories that I hear when talking to scientists is the whole permafrost situation, the amount of carbon that's locked up in there that could be released, the amount of methane that comes up under these puddles or little lakes that form. It's a worrying situation.
Yes. Colleagues have measured substantial methane fluxes from thawing permafrost. And, you know, even back in the 1990s, we had an experiment in the Arctic. And we looked at the concentration of carbon dioxide in the winter snowpack. So we pull samples of the air out of the snowpack in the middle of the winter. And we were shocked that we were getting levels of 1.5 to almost 2 times the atmospheric concentration in the snow. And this meant the CO2 had to be coming out of the frozen soil over the winter. which meant that it was being released from the permafrost and that this was even happening when it was frozen, perhaps cracking as it refroze in the wintertime. But it also meant that there was respiration by microorganisms carrying on even in the cold winter period. So this hadn't been considered in the estimates of greenhouse gas emissions from Arctic soils. And it's now very well understood. And it's really a serious problem for the world because those soils continue to warm, the microbial activity continues to increase, and the permafrost continues to thaw, and we're releasing carbon that was stored thousands of years ago to the atmosphere very, very quickly.
John, part of your life specialty is cold water hydrology. What is that?
Well, that's the hydrology regions that have some kind of a noticeable winter when there's a snowpack or maybe the ground freezes for some part of the winter. It's an interesting hydrology to study because you need to study the normal summertime hydrology, the evaporation, the stream flow processes, groundwater, runoff. But then you also need to look at snow melt, frozen soils, and snow trapped in trees. Snow that blows around in the wind, things like this. So there's a lot of extra complexity to it.
And regarding the problem of mountain water, where you just attended the summit, what can we do? Are there key steps to be taken?
Well, yes, there are. And the mountains are a great example of cold regions hydrology. But one thing it calls to attention again that we have to start to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere and get the concentrations of those gases back down. But we know that's going to take a while. So in the meantime, we have changing stream flows out of the mountains. We may have to build our dams differently or operate them differently. We may have to build different sorts of flood defenses around communities downstream of mountains or in the mountains. We may have to make different decisions about where we generate hydroelectricity or grow food by irrigation from mountain water supplies. And there'll be difficult decisions as ski areas become unviable in some areas, as our favorite spots to look at, famous glaciers such as one can see at the back of Lake Louise, the Victoria Glacier, become invisible over time as they retreat. And so we'll lose the scenic grandeur of our mountains and the ecosystems there, as well as the essential mountain water supplies.
From the University of Saskatchewan, we've been speaking with Dr. John Pomeroy. He is really a founder of many water studies in Canada and around the world. John is part of a group of international scientists warning about the impacts of climate change on the mountain water that keeps billions of humans alive. You can find links to John's works and science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. John Pomeroy, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you so much, and what a wonderful interview. Good questions. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. As world media shows us the great city of Venice going underwater, I recommend you go back to our recent broadcast about Venice in Rising Seas with our Italian guest Luca Muscara. He said this would happen and why? That program is available free on our website at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. While you are there, check out fire expert Greg Mullins with the true story of the current extreme fire danger for Australia. More news before it's news from Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When forests are logged or burned, carbon floods into the atmosphere, as you might imagine, but that is not the end of it. The loss continues for decades as a significant factor in climate change. In fact, a new paper from a young Australian scientist says experts and planners underestimate the true costs of hacking into tropical rainforests by a stunning 626%. That means the damage to the atmosphere is six times greater than previously thought. The new paper in the prestigious journal Nature was published October 30, 2019. We reached the lead author, Dr. Sean L. Maxwell, at the University of Queensland in Australia, but right now he's in Vienna, Austria. And Sean published important work while still an undergraduate, holds a diploma in yoga education from India, and speaks passably the Indonesian language of Bahasa. From Vienna, Sean Maxwell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. Great to be talking with you. This most recent paper is not in Nature, but in Science Advances. It is a Nature journal, but it's the sister journal to Nature.
Okay. I suspect you're more than a scientist. Are you also a passionate conservation activist?
Oh, it's hard. I spend so much time in the office, so it's hard to really believe in myself when I say I'm an activist as well. I certainly have seen the activities that have been all the marches in the street that are happening around the world, particularly by young folks, and very inspired by that. But certainly the majority of my time I'm spending in the office trying to push forward the science.
And you bounced into public view with your 2016 article, Guns, Nets, and Bulldozers Driving Species Loss. You argued climate change isn't killing species. We do most of it the old-fashioned way. Is that correct?
That's what the current numbers say, that the greatest number of species are in fact threatened by hunting and over-harvesting and also logging and unsustainable use of natural resources generally. An important caveat of that study was that a lot of current assessments aren't able to truly capture the impact of climate change and what that'll have in the future. So we expect in the next few decades that climate change will become a more prevalent factor for biodiversity generally, but certainly at the moment, in the near term, next 10 to 20 years, deforestation, hunting are still the biggest drivers of biodiversity decline globally.
I'm not going to lie to you. Trying to sell tropical forests must be saved isn't as easy these days. Perhaps issue fatigue has set in, but now your team shows intact forest loss is a critical factor for whether we win or lose the climate fight. Sean, talk to us about the old and the new vision of tropical forests vis-a-vis climate.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think you're quite right there that, the global community, policymakers, scientists have for a long time now talked about the importance of forests generally, tropical forests in particular, not just for climate, and that is an important issue, but for other big factors as well, such as natural disaster mitigation, given that they prevent things like landslides and flooding events. In certain cases, they're also able to increase local amounts of rainfall. And, and most importantly, from an ecologist's perspective, is they maintain their strongholds for large amounts of biodiversity as well. So, despite all that messaging that's been happening for a long time, still not quite seeing enough funding and action towards the conservation of tropical forests in particular. From the carbon point of view, we think that's maybe because conventionally we just only look at emissions, the carbon amount of carbon emitted from just the clearance of forests. So that is a switch from at a site, a forested area, to a completely non-forested area. So that is to this day still a major factor when we look at emissions globally. But increasingly, there's more studies coming out that show that degradation of forests are actually playing a big role as well, and that once you clear a forest, you create essentially new forest edges. And these new forest edges, the conditions in those edges are different to what they were before the clearance event happened. Those conditions are often drier, they're often windier. The drying and the wind brings with it more tree mortality, so that can be a source of emissions. And we're starting to get a bit of an idea of what that means in the whole scheme of things for global climate. But importantly as well, once you clear a forest, you open it up to other activities such as logging and more hunting of these around these forests. So logging is important because you obviously selectively take out trees. And in most cases, those trees are either ground up or burnt, and there's an emission associated with that. The hunting element has a carbon factor as well, in that hunting often targets the species that do a great job of spreading seeds around the landscape and helping forests to regenerate. So once you've lost that regeneration factor, the ability for forests to actually store carbon and sequester carbon goes down as well. So whilst it takes a while to describe these things, and maybe I'm straining the attention of your listeners just getting through it all, but we know these factors are also important from the carbon story of forests. So the new age is starting to get at those elements and how we can better fund the retention of these important elements.
Now, supposing I had $10,000 in the bank, I mean, a man can dream, and I'm getting interest on it. Now, I take that $10,000 out and I lose it all at the casino. It's not just that I lost the $10,000. I've also lost all the interest I would have got on it for the next 10 or the rest of my life. And that, I think you put under the label of foregone carbon sequestration. Could you talk to us about what that means and why it matters?
Wow, what a fantastic analogy. I wish we had thought about that. That's a great way to describe what we think is a major advance that this paper we've published recently provides. So what you're talking about there is essentially what carbon forests could have sequestered had they remained intact. So what we actually we put a measure on that. We say if the intact forest areas that we're looking at, had they remained intact between the years 2000 and 2050, we know that they would have sequestered around a gigaton of carbon. And conventional ways of looking at the carbon impact of losing forests don't actually capture that very well at all. So we could refer to that as a foregone removal or foregone earning, if you like, of carbon. And whilst this study, our study, only looked at a small subset of forests globally, just those intact forests, the ones with very little human activities inside them, and parcels of intact forests that became non-intact recently. So we're only really looking at 50 million hectares of forest here. There's 500 million hectares of these intact forests remaining globally that we can apply this metric to, that we can better capture or account for their carbon impact if we conserve them properly.
How do you find out how much intact tropical forest there is?
There's quite a few different measures, different ways of cutting it. One measure is to look at land use change right back in time. So people much more clever than me have generated maps of how humans have changed land use, but even back to the year 1500, and projected that forward to essentially now, and any areas that were forested that we know are suitable for forested areas that haven't had noticeable and permanent amounts of land use change on them, so a switch from a forest to a grazing area, or a switch from a grazing area to a cropping area, or even a switch to an urban landscape, we can track these things through time, and essentially by a process of elimination, any areas that were not changed and are forested, we can refer to them as primary forests or intact forests. Another way, and perhaps a more up-to-date way, is to just look at the moment where, using satellites, where is the major human activities on Earth? Things like roads and buildings and agriculture. If we combine all those things, we can then, again, process of elimination, look at where those things are not, and we can refer to those or start to identify where the intact forests are.
Another little detail in your paper that really caught my eye was defaunation, and you talk about how a change in the animals in the forest can change the forest itself, and even that has a carbon effect. How does that work?
Yeah, again, this is an emerging science, really. We know that as forests become more accessible, as roads cut through forests, they're more likely to have hunting pressure inside them. And this is not sort of traditional subsistence hunting. This is typically hunting with quite modern instruments that we're looking at, and hunting that could be used to generate products for market or for export. So, and note that hunting pressure typically targets the species or the animals, be that a hornbill in Southeast Asia or an elephant in Central Africa, these animals that are really important for spreading seeds of big carbon trees that soak up a lot of carbon they rely on these animals to regenerate, to spread their seeds and to actually ensure that they the next generation of big trees is planted. So once you lose those animals, that we know we're now getting an idea of just what that means in terms of the carbon stored in a forest and its ability to sequester carbon in the future.
In 2018, you led another paper with seven co-authors, Conservation Implications of Ecological Responses to Extreme Weather and Climate Events. I kind of liked your working title better. I think I found it online. Global conservation priorities are ignorant to the extreme. So anyway, what's the scoop with extreme weather and conservation planning?
Yeah, I must apologise there. Sometimes when us scientists were trying to be as accurate as possible, we lose touch with what makes sense, I guess. But yes, that study was just looking at events that, I guess, are abnormal in terms of their magnitude or in terms of their frequency, I guess. You know, you mentioned that things are quite dry in your area of the world. I guess that that's historically as a precedent, but a lot of the areas that are known to be dry are becoming drier, so there's less rainfall and the rainfall's less often. So those sort of factors can help us decide when an event, a weather event, is actually extreme or whether it's just a kind of slight diversion from a historical baseline.
Yeah, here in Canada, we make some pretty big national parks and often trying to protect special animals or plant communities. And then it gets hotter, the fire rages over the protected area, or the water supplies go haywire. We almost need movable parks these days. What can we do?
Well, that's quite a forward-thinking idea. And one that still generates a lot of there's a paper back in 2010 written by some folks at the University of Queensland that proposed removing protected areas that are not effective and replacing them with ones that could maybe do more for biodiversity. But that was met with quite a bit of criticism, despite it being, you know, theoretically a quite defensible and maybe a smart move. So one of the pillars of protected areas are that they are permanent. So we're very reluctant, I guess, to propose moving them or making them in any way not permanent. But in many cases, just like you're saying, we need to change them, and that could benefit the actual objective of protected areas, which is actually to conserve, you know, the plants and animals on this earth. It could benefit from more dynamic planning, more adaptive planning, I guess. But getting the legislating that and making sure that flexibility is not abused by nations is something that we're still sort of grappling with as a scientific community.
And reading your new paper, I got bushwhacked by the simple phrase, all tropical forests outside protected areas are expected to be logged. It's all going to be logged? How far along are we with that?
Yeah, well, that's the statement. And again, it's not completely in agreement, but you know, in science, that's one of the nice sides. You can never have to look too far to find a debate. But certainly, there's a lot of evidence that most forests have already managed, and that they indeed will be logged again by the year 2050. So we are getting better at mapping where logging is occurring. So it's quite difficult to map where it is using satellites because it's harder to detect using satellites because often, in the tropics at least, logging is not a clear felling of a patch but just a thinning of a large area, a removal of the largest trees. But the way satellites are heading, the way smart people are analysing those satellite images, we're not too far away from being able to say this area was logged in this year. So then we'll get a better understanding of just the extent of logging and hopefully be better able to incentivise logging in certain areas where it's not going to affect or it's going to have less impact on biodiversity persistence, making sure that it doesn't occur in the old growth, highly carbon dense forests that are so important for biodiversity and the climate.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. My guest is Dr. Sean Maxwell from the University of Queensland. We are talking about how disappearing tropical forests can damage the climate for all of us. And you write about the big contribution protecting intact tropical forests can play, helping countries reach their commitments for the Paris Climate Agreement. But what do you mean? I mean, do places like the Congo, that is heavily forested, we hope, somehow need forest credits to meet their emission rights?
Certainly. I mean, again, our study focused on those intact systems. So whilst there's a lot of, relatively, there is some funding for preventing deforestation, especially in tropical countries that are developing, a lot of that money is targeted at the deforestation frontier, they say, which is just those areas in countries where deforestation rates were quite high in recent years. So while that's important to prevent, there's almost no funding going towards the countries or the areas that are doing a really good job of looking after old growth intact forests. So what our study does is just reveal just how important these areas are for the climate, and just how much the countries and the local communities, just how important it is that these people and countries continue to conserve them, the intact forest in particular, and they need more support to do that, essentially. More funding, more attention, more of a social license as well. It's very tempting to, instead of conserving these intact forests, receive one-off or partial financial payments to clear it and to convert it for other uses.
So is there a working mechanism where polluting nations like Germany or China can gain climate credits by protecting intact tropical forests somewhere else?
Yeah, there sure is. Yeah, sure is, Alex. There's an existing framework called, collectively referred to as Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation. But it's also called RED Plus. So that's the acronym. And that does already have guidelines that permit or that reward, incentivize the retention of intact forests. It's just the way in which people are accounting for that retention, that are accounting for the climate benefits of that retention of intact forests in particular, that's not quite accurate. It's not really representative of how important it is, and therefore efforts that conserve intact forests are not rewarded as much as efforts that look at the deforestation frontier, those areas that are under immediate threat and have large amounts of loss in the recent past.
So do citizens of already industrialized countries, sitting comfortably at home, looking at wildlife videos on YouTube, do they have any right to advise or demand forest conservation action from tropical countries where millions of people are unemployed or live in poverty?
Well, I think certainly demand is the wrong approach, and will be met with either silence if those people in tropical developing countries are polite, but could equally and quite rightly be met with frustration. I think a more productive and reasonable and appropriate way is to just support those nations. So be that by just sharing the message, talking with people about how there's a continuum of forest quality, and at the moment we're just looking at those forests that are right at the edge of where humans are expanding their footprint, to those really, really high quality, intact, and in some places remote forests that people in many cases are still living in and actually maintaining these forested areas. So and so just recognising that initially, there's a continuum of quality within forests, and we need to fund forest conservation in ways that make sure we do still capture the best quality forests and ensure that any development that doesn't occur just doesn't sweep right through the centre of the heart of the most high quality, most important forests that we have left. So supporting nations, you know, either at the voting booth or through donations to groups, people in countries that are not tropical, that are developed, can support nations in that way, rather than just demanding that these countries do what's good for the planet without being properly rewarded or recognised for that.
Now, as we speak, Indonesia is transforming some of the last primitive rainforests into palm oil plantations or fiber for high-fashion clothes like nylon. Sean Maxwell, what is your assessment of the fate of Indonesia's forests?
Well, yeah, Alex, it's I don't want to be too negative here, but every time we look at this, we see Indonesia as critically important for biodiversity, one of the most biodiverse places on Earth, some of the most carbon-dense forests on Earth, but also a place where we've got population, high population density, proposals to move whole capital cities to highly forested nations. So I'm sure many of your listeners know that this proposal to move the capital city from Jakarta to Kalimantan, so the island of Kalimantan, which at the moment is one of the last homes for orangutans globally. So whilst the proposals to do that, they recognise that they need to have an eco-friendly capital city, and you know, we should commend them for that. Whether it will actually be eco-friendly and what that means, I'm sure we'll find out. But yeah, it's very concerning, and people need to change their individual behaviours beyond just advocating and supporting the countries, the people that are at the front line for forest conservation. The actions that individual people do take really do make a difference. So reducing your consumption is critical and very important. Don't ever dismiss that, the importance of that. And also other things broadly around population change as well. Whilst I view it as unethical to really force people to, of course, have either a certain number of children or none at all, that's unethical and that's something you never advocate for. But recognising that empowering women and giving women in developing nations in particular opportunities to have a good education and to be self-empowered are really important and the keys to reducing population growth rates, which are driving these pressures on intact forests globally.
So it seems to me that you're not just a lone wolf in the way you operate. You try to bring people together for some common cause, whether it's landowners or government types or scientists. Why is that important to you, Sean?
I just think it's the only way forward. It is when we get into a cycle of just pursuing personal agendas or even agendas of research groups or governments without recognizing, without integrating other views and other perspectives. It's, we know from history that that is leads to either major crashes or in human quality of life or in certainly in terms of environmental condition, and also that it just perpetuates this cycle of not learning from our mistakes in the past.
You know, we have some listeners on college radio stations, and I think some of them are asking themselves, is there still time, is it still worthwhile to go through academia and maybe study for your doctorate while the world is heading into a climate emergency? What are your thoughts on that?
I can certainly understand people that have those thoughts, and you're not alone, first of all. To get through it in the short term, just lean on each other, find groups of people that you can discuss these sorts of things in ways that help you be critical but also progress through issues. But you should also know that there is change coming. So by 2050, hopefully, we would have sorted out sustainable consumption patterns, sustainable population growth, these major factors that are driving ecological damage around the world. There's big international agendas that are set out to do just that, resolve those issues. Once we get those things right, the landscape and the seascape for biodiversity will change. And then the question will be, instead of how do we best retain the last of the best, or biodiversity generally, how can we actually regenerate those species that have been lost in the past or those ecosystems that have been lost in the past? There's still going to be lots of questions that need to be answered in the future by very smart people. So certainly still pursue it if you're passionate about it, because there's lots to be done.
Is it your sense that there is support now among more Australians for climate action, or is it still a tug of war between the jobs and coal crowd and the Greens?
It's a tough one to gauge. Whilst there is that division between the jobs and coal and the Greens, I think it's fair to say that the jobs element is really under question by the majority of Australians now. There's just too many studies coming out that showing that continuing to pursue down an avenue of coal exports and a one-dimensional economy generally around exporting coal and natural resources – is going to be a liability for Australia's economy in the future. We need to diversify jobs, we need to diversify skill sets in Australia, or be left behind. So whilst the coal community are doing all they can to sort of prevent climate change, the government in particular and people need to support more conscious effort, more meaningful effort towards Australia's contribution to climate change. And again, within the divisions, I think, and it's present around the world, young versus old, if I might say, whilst the younger generation recognise that what we've done to the climate in the past will especially impact them, they want action on climate change. They want Australia in particular to play their role, just like we have in past major events, despite not having a per capita contribution to certain things. We've always wanted and taken great pride in doing more than is actually on paper required of us. So we want to play that role. We can play that role. We're developed, a rich country, and the world needs us to do that. So time will tell whether we do or not, but it certainly has my support and the support of many other people in Australia.
Yeah, we need you to help us by cutting back the coal production and exports, but the people of Australia need the rest of the world so that, well, frankly, the parts of the country don't burn down every year, as is currently happening, and to get past the drought, perhaps, and all sorts of problems that global climate change is going to bring back to Australia. So as we wrap up here, Sean, how can people follow your work?
Well, a few different ways. We've got a website called greenfirescience.com. Their contact details are on there. So get along to the website and you can find our contact details there. Keep in touch with all the latest. The University of Queensland School of Earth and Environmental Sciences website is also a good resource to track. And look out for opportunities, say, if anyone out there would like to come and do a bit of research in the lab or at least get a feel for what it's like. We're always looking for passionate and keen students to help us out. And just personally as well, you can contact me in different ways. I'm sure maybe on the online version of this presentation, this interview, I'll happily put my email address alongside it if that helps.
I'll tack that right in my blog at ecoshock.org. We've been speaking with Dr. Sean L. Maxwell. His latest publication just out at the end of October is Degradation and Foregone Removals Increase the Carbon Impact of Intact Forest Loss by 626%. Sean, good to meet you, and keep the scientific information coming. We need it.
Oh, thanks so much, Alex, for your attention to this and for comprehending it all as well. Fantastic job.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. It's my honor and life work to bring science of the future direct to you. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.